Inoho, please be seated.
Mr. Law.
Good afternoon. I just want to explore with you the concerns that you've expressed in your summary statement today in relation to the staging of, or the potential option of staging of consents. And in order to understand what the future consenting environment from a timing perspective might look like as a result of Plan Change 7, it's when you think about the 6 years is going to run from the date on which consents were granted. And when you think about the consent applications that are in the system at the moment in relation to the deemed permits, it's highly unlikely that those will all be processed and granted on the same date.
That's correct. I don't imagine that they would all have the exact same expiry date, but if we look at the Manuhirikia as an example, you know, all of the deemed permits in that catchment were filed as one application, so that's a large chunk of them that effectively would be granted with the same date. But I think the point being that even if they're within a few months of each other, the amount of time and work that has to go in terms of preparing what are large applications, which are complex, my point being that even if they're only a few months apart, it's a question of, from a resourcing point of view, how do we simply do that, and are we setting ourselves up for the same challenges and issues that we've had to contend with a common expiry date of October 21? So it may well not eventuate, but it may well eventuate too.
But isn't the reality that if you were to put in place a staged process where it might be, and I'm picking numbers out of thin air, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, etc., across the region to try and stage the consent applications, isn't it likely that you'd still stage it so that the Manuhirikia, for example, that those consents are coming in at the same time?
Yes, you would, but let me reframe that. In terms of an outcome from a staged approach, what it means is there are a very small pool of consultants who work in the replacement of deemed permits. I think Ms. McKee alluded to the fact yesterday that there was effectively three firms that have done the majority of the work in that space. So I guess the point being, certainly with a LAMPRO hat on, when we have multiple applications across multiple catchments, it becomes logistically challenging if they were all due at the same time.
So though that would then, or those concerns relate perhaps to the renewal or the subsequent replacement of the deemed permits that are all expiring this year.
Yeah.
When you think about PC7 also capturing other RMA permits that expire between now and 2025, those permits are going to already be staggered, aren't they?
Those ones are, yes, but look, I don't have the exact numbers of how many of those permits that are not currently deemed permits expire between now and 2025. I don't have those numbers to hand. But it's fair to say that those permits are probably slightly less complex, I would suggest, in their nature. They may well be smaller individual type takes rather than the complex scheme takes.
Might it be that the land and water plan to come sets out a really clear planning framework such that the time and effort required to prepare consent applications is much reduced compared to the current situation where there simply isn't the planning guidance?
Look, that is possible, and I guess I have not seen a version of the future water and land plan to be able to provide any meaningful comment on that point. But what I would say, based on my experience, is that when we look at the requirements set out in the new NPS and the NES and the path and the process that councils have to follow to implement that, I would suggest if I reflect back on the last 18 years I've been acting as a planner, that the planning framework gets more complex, not less complex. So using my judgment and my experience, I would suggest that even with an exceptionally good framework, there will still be a much greater and more complex process than we've probably had to deal with in the past. And that perhaps touches on some of those points that Mr. Craw alluded to this morning around, when we look at the degree of change that's on our tables and on our plates, we're actually not just having conversations about consents. These conversations are actually far broader than that. And so when we weigh up all of those things, when we are working alongside our clients, there's a lot going on. It's not a case of, I need a consent, can you prepare it and lodge it next week? Those days have long gone.
Doesn't having an operative planning framework reduce, though, the need to go up and look at superior documents? So thinking of the NPSFM to start with, that document will need to be given full effect to in the new land and water plan to come. And so that's not going to be a consideration then in terms of reconsenting in the way that perhaps it has been going into this point in time.
Look, that's correct to a degree, but I think my point about this potential conflict and timeline is that if a new water and land plan is notified but is not yet operative, and that date coincides with when we need to start preparing our applications for the, say, the six-year replacement, that we have a perfect storm, so to speak, in the middle where we have to consider all of these things. And when we look at the NESFM, there are some aspects that expire in 2025 that will then obviously be captured in the new water and land planning framework. But in the interim, there are also, if people are granted consents under the NES today, some of those consents can be granted for a maximum term of 10 years. So there will be some crossover for some time. It won't just be a case of, in my opinion, that water and land plan is notified and now we don't need to consider anything else. So again, it's kind of a transitional period.
And when you think about the time for the new land and water plan, my understanding is that's to be notified no later than December 2023, and that'll go through a one-stop shop in terms of the new Freshwater Planning Commission. And so when you think about the expiry of permits issued under Plan Change 7, if Plan Change 7 is approved, being 6 years after they were granted, those permits are going to get pushed out, or the dates are going to be perhaps at the earliest late 2027, in all likelihood 2028.
Sorry, what's going to be pushed out?
The six-year date, yeah, from which renewed deemed permits are granted.
Yeah.
So Plan Change 7 says 6 years from date of grant.
Mm-hmm.
Those permits they will expire, therefore, in 6 years,
yeah,
or 6 years after they're granted.
Yeah.
And they haven't been granted yet. Applications are in the system.
Yeah.
So if those permits are granted either later this year or, say, early next year, that puts the future renewal date or the expiry date out to 2027, 2028.
Mm.
So when you think about the new land and water plan, there will have already been time for that plan to bed in ahead of that next round of reconsenting.
Yes, that is possible. I guess my understanding is that the NPS drop dead date for notification is 2024. I'm not wholly across the direction for the ORC to notify 1 year earlier, but I guess when we consider what the NPS directs, which is 2024, there is still a potential for crossover, in my opinion.
Are you aware that there's a ministerial direction in place in relation to the Otago Regional Council and the requirement to produce its land and water plan and notify no later than December 2023?
Yes, I'm broadly aware of that.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Baker-Gallery. Thank you, Mum. Just on the same concept of staging the reconsenting going forwards, another way of perhaps picking up that matter of principle is, rather than it being dealt with in Plan Change 7, the Land and Water Plan could put in place a framework that enabled, that mitigated the risk of a bottleneck, a consenting bottleneck. For example, it could, for some catchments or sub-catchments, allow for an additional tiny rollover and other catchments, implementation of the land and water plan framework, you know, on its, you know, becoming in effect on its notification. So if that concept as a matter of principle, it, you know, becomes obvious as being necessary to reduce the, you know, the adverse effect of the bottleneck, do you agree that that could be picked up on in the land and water plan as well?
Yes, that could equally be a method that could achieve that. I think I would point out, however, that we also have a whole bunch of irrigators and water users who have been through, have been working towards 2021, are now facing a short-term rollover, and I suggest that their appetite or patience for another short-term rollover, if it was to come through in a water and land plan, might be not well received, would be my view.
Thank you, Mel. No further questions.
Re-examination. Commissioner.
No, Mr. Moore asked my questions. Thank you.
Commissioner. And if there was an appetite by the Regional Council to do staging and sequencing of catchments or sub-catchments for consent, is that is there capacity still to pick that up in the proposed RPS?
I'm not sure I feel capable of commenting on that because I haven't really been involved with the RPS and haven't seen what that document would entail.
All right. All right, well, those are our questions, or my question anyway. Anything arising? Nothing arising, so thank you very much for your
evidence. I just had one point of clarification that came up through Ms McKeague's evidence yesterday. She indicated that the permit for Falls Dam was held by the Falls Dam Company. It's actually held by the Omakau Irrigation Company. So I you may want to know that or correct that for the record.
No, it's okay. So in somebody at some stage will produce the Falls Dam consents and...
Yes.
You know, answer the elusive question of who is the dam owner, and who are the obligations to maintain and those dam structures. But I think that's the witness to come, Mr. Curran.
Correct. Yep.
All right. Hey, thank you very
much. Thank
you. Okay. And so that's your last witness for today. Mm-hmm. Very good. Where are we going? Are we going to Federated Farmers?
Yes, we are.
Ms Riley's not here.
She is, but she's asked me to introduce her witnesses.
Yep, sorry, I didn't think you were here. I didn't see you at the back. Sorry, what were you
going to
say?
Ms Riley's asked whether I would have the witnesses or assist with swearing in the witnesses.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm happy to do
that. Do you want
to
come forward? Yep.
In terms of timing, ma'am, we now seem to be nearly ahead of schedule. Do you want me to see if one of my easier fish and game witnesses is available, or shall we just leave it till tomorrow?
Just flag it, I think everybody's been working extraordinary hours and should have the day off. Well, you know, what's left of the day off anyway.
Very good.
We have Dr. Fiona Doolan-Noble, who I think is all ready to zoom in onto the screen.
Yeah, that sounds good. So we could bring up the AVL witness.
Good afternoon, Dr. Doolan-Noble. Can you hear us?
Good afternoon. Yes, I can. Thank you.
Do you confirm that your full name is Fiona Doolan-Noble?
I do.
And you have produced a statement of evidence in chief in relation to Plan Change 7, dated February 2021?
I have.
And in that statement of evidence, you've set out your qualifications and experience at paragraphs 1 to 7?
I did, yes.
Are there any corrections that you wish to make to your statement of evidence?
There are no corrections. There are some points I would like to emphasise.
What I would perhaps have you do, if you would first confirm that the evidence that you have produced and the evidence you're about to give today is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief.
I state that it is true and correct to the best of my knowledge and my belief.
Now, I understand that you have some key points that you wish to highlight for the court with respect to the matters covered in your evidence. If you could please highlight those key points now and then remain for any questions that may follow.
I will, thank you. So the point I really want to highlight is that the changes to water rights add an additional level of adversity for farmers to deal with. And a recent Australian paper has actually highlighted the significant unintended consequences that changes to water rights can have on farmers. I have the paper and I'm happy to provide it to the court should you wish to read it. The adversity related to changes in water rights is strongly linked to uncertainty and constraints. And having read some of the evidence from others and from farmers who have already been before the court, I'm sure you are familiar with the significance of uncertainty and constraints to these farmers. This heightened personal adversity is then layered with experience of community adversity. So community adversity, for example, are the Southland floods, the Otago drought 2020, and the M-bovis, mycoplasma bovis situation, which is still ongoing and hasn't been resolved. On top of that, we have another layer. We have global uncertainty with the COVID pandemic and for many farms, unfilled vacancies. So it's not hard to see, and I really want to emphasise that this layering of adversity can leave a farmer in a very dark place. As I'm sure you'll appreciate, PC7, if it goes ahead and modified, any agriculture adjustment will be initially internalised by the farmer and his family or her family. It would have to be a hope that these changes were not going to be associated with any unintended consequences within the Otago region. And I personally would like to suggest that further work is required in order to explore more fully the implications of the changes and the magnitude of the social cost that may be borne by the farmer, his family or her family, and the associated rural communities. There needs to be a defining of the limits of acceptable change in terms of social impact that this court is willing to support and endorse. And finally, I would also like to take a moment to formally acknowledge the emotional labour that farming women do and the excellent job they have done in coming and communicating with you all in the court. Thank you.
Your question, Mr. Moore.
Do you have your statement of evidence in chief with you?
I do, yeah.
If you could turn to the final paragraph, paragraph 26.
Yeah.
The second sentence in that paragraph caught my eye. PC7 has the potential to increase the chance that Otago farmers will experience longer or more lasting effects of a drought. Now, I appreciate that your evidence was written based on the notified version of Plan Change 7. Things have moved on a little since the notified version came to fruition. Do you have a working knowledge, or have you had a chance to keep up to date with the work of the technical experts in relation to Plan Change 7?
I haven't been able to, due to my workload, been able to keep up with the changes that you've made to plan change 7 and the, so I haven't, no, sorry.
So if you will accept for a moment that plan change 7 is not intending to take any water off of farmers compared to the water that has historically been used, but rather it's seeking to roll over the existing historical use of water, would the issue that you have addressed in this part of your final paragraph, would that be addressed?
So how long will the rights be signed for? How long do the farmers have to have repeated applications to maintain the same amount of water rights?
Was the point that you were making in your paragraph 26 that Plan Change 7 has the potential to reduce water allocations to farmers?
My understanding initially was that if the farmer didn't get the resource consent for water, then it had the potential, in view of climatic change, to increase the chance of drought within Otago, which is a dry region. So if you're saying to me there's going to be no change in the water allocation to the farm, but the farmer has to apply every 6 years or 5 or 10 years for that resource allocation, then what that is going to is potentially it will increase the chance of drought, because who's to say that the resource allocation will be allocated?
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you.
Don't think there's any questions from you, Ms Baker Galloway.
No, thank you, ma'am.
Any follow-up questions? No, no, okay. Okay, so Judge Borthwick speaking. The impact on farmers is in abundant evidence in this hearing. Not just simply the impact of PC7, but the impact of policy signalling prior to PC7 being notified and farmers acting on those signals, but not necessarily now to their advantage. You know, PC7 is approved in the way that it's been amended. And that has put enormous stress on individuals, and as you rightly point out, it's not just an individual stress, but it's individuals, it's both people, their families and their community. What would you have the court do, though, right now? Yeah. How do you manage that? Is it because the courts... not through any choice of itself, but is asked to make a decision. So it's come to us, we must make a decision. So what would you have the court do in terms of being mindful of the social and personal cost of these procedures?
Your Honour, that's a very good question. I'm not sure how it ever... actually came to this, to this process, and why it couldn't have been sorted in a more timely fashion outside of court. I'm not 100% clear on that, but that certainly, I think, would be a better approach. My experience of working with farmers, and especially around Mbogus, is that their knowledge, what farmers know, isn't taken into consideration. So it's not at all privileged. No one values their knowledge. And it leaves them feeling quite demeaned. That is on top of everything else that's going on within the public purview, in the media, on social media. So actually, you used to be proud to say you were a farmer. I'm not a farmer. You used to be proud to be able to say you're a farmer, but that pride has actually gone for a lot of our farmers. I do think this if the resource consents are quite short term in terms of access to water rights, that puts a significant burden on the farmer and family. And I have to ask then, why would their sons or daughters potentially want to take over the farm? And if they're not going to farm, who's going to farm first? Who's going to grow our fibre? Who's going to grow our food? And is that where we really want to see things going? Otago is a significant agricultural region for this country, so we really need to think carefully. I think, listening or reading some of the evidence to date, I think there's been, and I think you've alluded to, there has been damage, emotional trauma done to some of the farmers that have come to speak to you within this court. So again, I say I'm not sure how it came to this, but it would be better, I feel, for everyone if issues like this could be sorted outside of court. And if people understand that farmers have valuable knowledge and it is worth listening to, perhaps things could have been resolved in another fashion.
I don't disagree. We've seen the trauma, and so to have farmers come before us and give evidence, notwithstanding that trauma, points to real courage and strength. And I don't think, or I would not want it thought, that this court only listens to experts. It's not either or, it's and in both. And my farmers, who appear before us on this hearing, are experts in farming systems and are taken very seriously. It really is and in both, in order to get, the full picture of what is actually happening in the region, what could happen in the region. And I think that's going to become extremely important for yet another plan change which has come before the court, Plan Change 8, where the court's going to be listening hard to farmers, not just experts, because the court regards farmers as being experts in their own systems. In terms of trauma, we've got, the debate is between short-term consents and with that all of the uncertainty that your evidence talks about, together with uncertainties created by other things also happening within the wider environment, and you've touched upon those and other witnesses have touched upon that as well. It's not just this plan change. So that's short-term consents. Long-term consents come with it also, I think, considerable uncertainty. That is, you may get your consent, but then there may be a review coming, and a review which, even on the farmer's own evidence, may require wholesale changes to irrigation, on-farm systems, methods of conveyance, and on-farm storage. So you've got, if you like, two burdens, short-term or long-term, both with their attendant risks and both with uncertainties. So how does the court manage that? Because those are there's nothing but hard decisions in this case, and there are two of them. And in terms of managing that process, how do you, the decision's the one for the court to make, but how do you manage that in terms of that decision? How does that impact of uncertainty get factored into account?
All I can say at this point, Your Honour, is I'm glad I haven't got the court's decision to make, because you are right, you weigh up uncertainty, and uncertainty is undoubtedly linked to moral distress, which then again is linked to moral residue and then burnout and then potentially unintended consequences. I think, I don't think I'm the person to answer that question. I think in what would be preferred by the farmer, farmers need to answer that tough question, because I take your point. You might come to a long-term resolution in terms of access, and then something may happen and there is another review. I dare say you probably cannot go back and ask that question of the farmers that have already been. It would probably be another extension of the court. So I'm not sure how your judicial process works.
But it would be, in terms of managing stress, that farmers are presently under, do you have any recommendations to make? Because faced with hard decisions, that's what the court has to make. How does one take into account stressors on the farming community is feeding into that?
Yeah, I mean, in New Zealand we have got some great supports around farmers, such as the Rural Support Trust, which do really, really good work. I think at the moment things are at a very difficult point for farmers, because we've got the whole intensive winter grazing debate. And there they feel caught between a rock and a hard place. You spend $1 million on a wintering shed, you get the animals off the paddock. Those that are concerned about the paddock well-being are happy, but then the animal welfare group aren't happy because the cattle are inside. So life of a farmer at the moment just is really, really difficult. The other issue being, of course, that when they are stressed, quite often they don't go and seek medical advice or support. Part of that is because of the intimacy of many rural communities when you go into a doctor's waiting room. The other is there are no health professionals around. It's very difficult for them to access. Doctors work within the day. Sometimes the farmer hasn't got the opportunity to go. So it is really difficult. Farmers seek support from their wives and within their families, generally. But the whole thing around stress at the moment, the way I see it within farming, is there's almost a perfect storm brewing. And that is my concern. I know you're going to hear from the Rural Support Trust, and I'm sure they will tell you just the increase in calls, etc. I can't answer your question. It is so difficult. There are so many things that are happening to support farmers, like we heard on TV1 this morning about surfing and farmers. There's lots and lots of initiatives, but whether the farmer accesses those or doesn't, it's very, very difficult. Unfortunately, we just hear about when things don't go well quite often, and that's difficult. That's difficult for, mainly for male farmers, but for female farmers as well.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Thank you. Have you got any questions?
No. Thank you very much.
Well, anything arising from the court's questions? Nothing. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time and for your evidence. It's very clear. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Now, we move on to Mr. Lord.
Otago Rural Support Trust, previous president of Federated Farmers and Farmer within Otago.
Okay. Right. Thank you. Okay, so I think that's us for today.
Yes,
it is. It is, yeah. And so we're back here on Tuesday. Oh.
No, are we?
God, what day is it? Honestly, I really thought it was... I thought it was Thursday today. I've been going at this too long. All right, no, that's all good. I'll be here. Now that you care to mention it. Okay, no, that's fine. So we're here, back here tomorrow, and actually it's with your witness.
Yes, that's right, ma'am.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right, so we've seen Mr. Farrell's evidence. It's been uplifted, or should be uplifted overnight. To the website, yeah. You've distributed it. Have you sent it out, or later?
I think it got sent out last night.
Sent out last night. It's just the question is, when does it get uplifted to the website in order for...
No, that's what I mean. I think it got uplifted to the website last night.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
Right, good.
I've got hard copies here if anyone needs a hard copy.
Okay, no, that's good. Anything else we need to do?
There's lots to be done, but nothing more today that...
Yep.
No, nothing else. Thank you.
Okay, good. All right. Okay, no, that's fine. All right, well, thank you very much, and I'll work out what those orders might look like for the non-publication. All right, thank you.
Your Honour, please.
All rise.